statements were tremendously effective for three reasons. First, like all convincing statements, they were true or irrefutable. When she said, "I love my children," that was probably true on some level. When she said, "I would never hurt my kids," that was heartbreakingly untrue. But at the time she made it, it was irrefutable. Second, convincing statements usually incorporate emotion. In this case, the officer said that when Ms. Smith made those statements, the investigators could see tears welling up in her eyes. The emotion is what expresses the conviction. Emotion in and of itself isn't necessarily truthful or deceptive, but untruthful people use it to enhance the deception. The third factor is that the statements were consistent with the investigators' bias. "In our experience, moms just don't kill their kids," the officer told us. "And they darn sure don't do it in Union, South Carolina." That was interesting. "Where do moms kill their kids?" Phil asked. "Well, you know," the officer responded. "New York, L.A., Chicago." Even police officers can make a shaky generalization that the rest of us might also find ourselves making. Unlike qualifiers, we consider each convincing statement as a separate deceptive indicator. So two convincing statements constitute a cluster. They're that powerful. Neutralize convincing statements. The way to combat convincing statements is to neutralize them, to render them ineffective by acknowledging or agreeing with them. This, of course, needs to be distinguished from agreeing with the action. In the Susan Smith example, it would sound something like this. "Susan, I know you love your kids. I think that's evident to everybody." She might think for a fleeting moment, "I have them." But the next step is to stay on point and keep right on going in the original direction. "Susan, we want to talk to you now about what really happened. We want to go over your story again." The message that's delivered is this. "We asked you a question. We heard what you said, and what you said had no impact on where we're going with this conversation." The beauty of it is you deliver that message below the radar. Above the radar would be, "Wait a minute, Susan, I don't believe you. I think you're lying through your teeth." That triggers defenses, and the person shuts down. Our job is to get her to open up to us. This tactic is enormously powerful and effective, whether a parent is speaking with a child, an employer is speaking with an employee, or a CIA officer is speaking with a terrorist. A tip for parents. If you're a parent and the time has come for you to speak to your child about drug use, bear in mind that you must go into L-squared mode when you talk to your child, and be especially alert for convincing statements. Our experience has shown that teens who have experimented with drugs, when confronted by their parents, tend to rely heavily on convincing statements. If your child has not experimented with drugs, his likely response to your question will be something like, "Absolutely not," or "No way." Kids who have used drugs are unlikely to deny it. Instead, they typically rely on convincing statements such as, "I can't believe you would think I would do that. I've never given you any reason to think that. Why don't you trust me? You're accusing me just because Josh got caught and Josh is my friend." You'll find a list of suggested questions to ask your child about drug use in Appendix 1. Convincing statements. "No one would ever question my honesty." "I have a great reputation." "I'm an honest person." "My word is my bond." "It's not in my nature to do something like that." "I always try to do the right thing." "I would never jeopardize my job by doing something like that." "How could you even think I could be involved in something this serious?" "I have worked here for over 20 years. I love you. I would never do anything to hurt you." Chapter 7. The Wrath of the Liar. No man lies so boldly as the man who is indignant. Friedrich Nietzsche. In a federal courthouse in Houston on April 10, 2006, Jeffrey Skilling, the former CEO of Enron Corporation, took the witness stand at his own trial. He was charged with conspiracy, securities fraud, insider trading, and making false statements to auditors in the wake of the spectacular collapse of the now-defunct energy services company, and he took the stand to profess his innocence. Skilling raised his right hand as the court clerk administered the oath, Do you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do,
Skilling replied, and he took his seat. Think back to Chapter 5, and the all-encompassing nature of that oath, how it covers every type of lie Skilling could conceivably tell. Lies of commission, lies of omission, and lies of influence. It's fascinating to consider what must have been going through Skilling's mind as he took that oath. Did he feel boxed in or cornered because the facts weren't his ally and the stakes were so enormous? Was that what caused him to lash out at those he blamed for his predicament? The witch hunt started, Skilling told the jurors. People lost money. People lost jobs. The easiest thing to do is look for witches. The jury apparently wasn't swayed. 45 days later, it returned a verdict of guilty on 1 count of conspiracy, 1 count of insider trading, 5 counts of making false statements to auditors, and 12 counts of securities fraud. Skilling was sentenced to 24 years and 4 months in prison and fined $45 million. 5 years before Skilling took the stand that day, he was already showing signs of feeling cornered. In a conference call with analysts and reporters on April 17, 2001, Richard Grubman, managing director of Highfields Capital Management in Boston, challenged Skilling over Enron's refusal to release its balance sheet along with its earnings statement. You're the only financial institution that can't produce a balance sheet or cash flow statement with their earnings, Grubman said. Well, thank you very much, Skilling replied. We appreciate it, asshole. No doubt there was much going through Skilling's mind that day about what was happening in Enron that he was unable or unwilling to share in response to the questions that were being asked. Less than 8 months later, on December 2, 2001, Enron would file for bankruptcy protection. Skilling could see that life as he knew it was unraveling, and he likely could envision a realistic scenario in which he would suffer serious consequences. Attack behavior such as that exhibited by Skilling in that conference call and on the witness stand can be an especially powerful indicator of deception. The more desperate a situation is, the more a person will feel prone to attack. So, when we see this behavior in response to a question, it tells us that the person is particularly highly stressed by that question, and that it's an area that strongly warrants further attention. One of the deceptive behaviors we introduced in Chapter 5 was exhibiting an inappropriate level of concern. As we said, when the facts are not a person's ally, he might resort to a strategy of attempting to diminish the importance of the issue by responding to it in an inappropriately light-hearted manner. In some instances, this behavior could be a form of attack or aggression. When TV journalist Diane Sawyer conducted her January 28, 2003 interview with Scott Peterson, the Modesto, California man, who was eventually convicted of murdering his pregnant wife, Lacey, in one of the highest-profile homicide cases of the decade, she asked him the question everyone wanted her to ask, point blank. Did you murder your wife? Peterson responded, No. No, I did not. Oddly, however, he was smiling as he said it. A more inappropriate behavior in response to such a gut-wrenching question is difficult to fathom. The psychological factors that such behavior might be attributed to are complex, but our experience has shown that a likely element in a reaction like the one exhibited by Peterson is a form of attacking behavior. A smile in response to a question about such a heinous crime might reflect a degree of condescension or dismissiveness that's intended as an assault on the questioner. Attack behavior can also take the form of a threat, and the threat can even be one that involves self-harm. We saw this during our polygraph days at the agency, where the stakes were especially high, and the environment in the polygraph division was especially tense. Prior to hooking the subject up to the polygraph machine, there is a pre-test interview, which reviews the issues that will be covered during the polygraph examination. This ensures that the subject is confident about his responses, and affords him the opportunity to get anything off his chest that may be directly related to the test question, or to discuss peripheral concerns. At the agency, these pre-test interviews necessarily covered extremely sensitive personal matters that have to be discussed to determine a person's suitability to be entrusted with information that involves not only our national security, but people's lives. It is an extremely intrusive, invasive procedure that people who have a desire to serve at the agency subject themselves to. Susan recalls having to interview one woman 4 times because of the behaviors she exhibited, and the woman grew increasingly upset. She finally threatened to jump off the agency's 7th floor balcony if Susan didn't back off. Those who knew Susan outside of the agency saw her as a typical soccer mom. This woman branded her the bleached blonde goddess of torture. More commonly, the attack behavior in that environment was a direct assault. Because of the particular work she did in the agency prior to becoming a polygraph examiner, Susan was routinely assigned to polygraph case officers. During the pretest interview of one male case officer, Susan raised the standard question about contact with foreign nationals and foreign intelligence services. That absolutely enraged the case officer. He blew up at Susan, launching into a tirade about how she can never understand the life of a case officer and the activities he or she engages in. Susan was unfazed. She didn't even hook him up to the polygraph machine. Before the end of the pretest interview, the case officer admitted that he had been sleeping with a woman who worked for a foreign intelligence service. Now, let's delve a little more deeply into how this behavior is typically exhibited in a more extended stimulus-response engagement. As we noted in Chapter 5, Christine O'Donnell, the former U.S. Senate candidate from Delaware, appeared on CNN's Piers Morgan Tonight to promote her book. In that chapter, we looked at O'Donnell's inconsistent statements. Here, let's focus on her attack behavior. Well into the interview, Morgan cited a 1996 MTV documentary in which O'Donnell spoke out against masturbation, and he asked her if her views on the matter had changed since then. O'Donnell, who was in a remote studio for the interview, responded that she had addressed the documentary in her book and had explained why she had raised the issue publicly at that point in her life. Morgan referred to other statements O'Donnell had made about abstinence and lust, and used the matter as a segue into a discussion of gay marriage and don't ask, don't tell. Let's pick up the exchange at that point and highlight the attack behaviors. Morgan. It's a natural extension to ask you, for example, a very relevant question for any politician, O'Donnell interrupting. I address it all in the book. O'Donnell is already squarely in attack mode. The interruption aims to prevent Morgan from getting the question out on the table. This discourteous behavior constitutes an attack on Morgan and the interview strategy and process he is attempting to execute. It strongly suggests that O'Donnell fears Morgan's question will put her in serious harm's way from a political standpoint. As a result, she tries to seize control of the interview and send Morgan a message that she will dictate what is discussed. Morgan. What is your view of gay marriage, for example? O'Donnell. I address that stuff in the book. I'm here to talk about... Morgan interrupting. You're on here to promote the damn book, so you can't keep saying it's all in the book. You've got to repeat some of it. O'Donnell. I'm here to talk about the book. Morgan. Yes, I'm talking about the book. You keep saying it's all in the book, so tell me what's in the book. O'Donnell. Why don't you ask me questions about what I say in the chapter called Our Follower in Chief, where I criticize Barack Obama? Why don't we talk about... Morgan. Because right now I'm curious about whether you support gay marriage. O'Donnell. You're borderline being a little bit rude, you know? I obviously... Morgan. Really? O'Donnell. I obviously want to talk about the issues that I choose to talk about in the book. At this point in the exchange, O'Donnell has launched a direct attack on Morgan by branding him as rude. At the same time, her statement that, I'm here to talk about the book, is glaringly inconsistent with her previous responses, in which she refuses to talk about issues that she acknowledges are in the book. In the face of Morgan's persistence on the gay marriage issue, O'Donnell is forced to backtrack and insist on discussing only the issues of her choosing. Morgan. Do you answer that question in the book? O'Donnell. I talk about my religious beliefs. Yeah, I absolutely do. Morgan. Do you talk about gay marriage in the book? O'Donnell. What relevance is that right now? Is there a piece of legislation? Morgan. It's obviously, as you know, because of Michelle Bachmann's views and others, it's obviously a highly contentious political issue. I'm just curious what your view is. You keep saying it's in the book, so I'm bemused as to why you wouldn't just say it in an interview if it's in the book. O'Donnell. Because I don't think it's relevant. It's not a topic that I choose to embrace. It's not what I'm championing right now. I've been there, done that, gone down that road. Right now, what I'm trying to do is promote a book that I hope to be a very inspirational story to people who are part of the Tea Party movement, so that they can continue in this movement to bring America back to the second American Revolution. That's my goal. That's my focus right now. Here, O'Donnell attacks Morgan by impugning the relevance of his question, and she has again failed to answer it. She clearly fears engaging Morgan on this issue. Morgan. So would you agree with Michelle Bachmann that we should maybe reinstate Don't Ask, Don't Tell?